Welcome to the Afternoon Jams live interview on radio and also on Facebook Live. 98.5 The Wire continues to bring you candidates who are on the ballot. Early voting has started here in Orlando, and election is next week, Tuesday. We're joined by Attorney Arnold, who is seeking the judge seat here in Orange County. How are you doing today, Attorney Arnold?
I'm very well. And yourself?
Doing good. Doing very, very well. Highly contested, quite a few people in this race. What made you decide to throw your name in there?
I've been an attorney here in the Central Florida area for the last 15 years. And so the Group 1 seat, the judge that we have, Judge Kest, is retiring. And I felt like that seat needed to be replaced by an attorney who had lots of trial experience. I felt like I was ready to serve my community in a more impactful way after being a trial lawyer for quite a while in this community. And I felt like it was my time to make an impact on our community in a different way. And so I thought I was ready. Still feel like I'm ready. I feel like I've been on the campaign trail now almost 2 years and feel like my community has told me I made the right decision and this was my time to represent our community.
Your pathway to this election cycle has taken you a long way. You studied up north, right?
Yes, Right. I'm originally from Pensacola, and then I went to undergrad in Mobile, Alabama, and then law school in FSU before I relocated here in 2004.
Now I read something about England, too, right? UK.
Yes, I got my comparative legal studies degree at Oxford University, which essentially just means that if I wanted to become a barrister, I could go sit for the exam and become a practicing lawyer in England as well. Yes, sir.
So what separates you from the other candidates in this race?
Mostly my trial experience. So my opponent in this race has only really ever practiced family law, which all of family law is done in front of a judge only, or a hearing officer only, or a magistrate. And I'm a trial attorney, so all of my practice has always been in front of juries, so 6 or 12. So I picked 6 or I picked 12, depending on the type of case it was. And all of my experience in trials has always been in front of juries for the most part. I have practiced and tried cases that have been bench trials, so meaning they have been decided by a judge. But the majority of all of my trial work, over 50 trials that I have tried as first chair, meaning I have done everything in the trial. From picking the jury to closing argument and everything in between. And then another 110, 120 or so where I've been part of a trial team where I've done something significant in the trial, have all been in front of juries. So either pick 6 or pick 12, not just in front of a judge. So it's much more significant amount of legal work. You know, a jury trial is going to take you just sheerly by the amount of work that you have to put in is going to last you longer than a bench trial. So I have a significant more amount of courtroom experience than my opponent.
Some of the issues that African Americans deal with when it comes down to jury trial is that the jury most of the time do not reflect its peers. How do you plan to correct that? And what is your feelings about that?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways that we hope to correct that, at least that I hope to correct that. One is being taking the courtroom and the judge aspect and making the courtroom more accessible to the community as a whole. I think that one of the things that's happened, at least that I've seen happen throughout my career, is that the community itself has become disjointed from the courthouse, meaning that the community doesn't know who its judges are and doesn't have a real touch point of reality of what judges do and who judges are. And so quite frankly, whether it's because they feel nervous about the court system and they have a negative feeling about the court system, or it's because they are fearful of the court system, or it's just because they don't know. They have not had an experience with the court system, and so they don't know. They don't really understand the importance, or even if they do understand the importance, their viewpoint of the court system is negative. And I think that we as judges, hopefully I'll be there in January and I can start the positive reflection of judges. We need to be out in our community having real life interjection with our community. And so I think if the community starts to see us for who we are and they can say, oh, that's Judge Arnold. You know, I see her in the grocery store. I see her at community events. I'm not afraid of her. I've talked to her in a social setting. Then they're much more likely to get involved and show up for jury duty. And that starts the ball rolling to start having a jury panel that reflects defendants and reflects the people that look like you, right?
Right.
You know, I think that's one way for it to happen. I think we also, I have young daughters, my husband and I do. So our daughters just this week started kindergarten and first grade. And so I think if judges and courtroom personnel start early in the school system and we start talking to kids about courtrooms aren't scary and courtrooms do positive things, and that it's not just that kids are seeing courtrooms as a negative thing, then kids start to grow up and they see that courtrooms can be positive. Then when they turn 18 and they become a registered voter, they're able to serve on juries. Then when they get a jury notice, instead of it being something negative, it becomes something positive. And if we start that early on, then our jury panels can start to reflect our community. We've got to start it from, it's got to start not only from the top down, but we've got to start from our communities upward. And the only way we can do that is if we get into our communities and we start working, we start becoming part of our communities. We can't just do that during election season when we're asking our voters to vote for us. We've got to be doing that all the time.
All right. I don't know if you followed the case in Kentucky where African-American judge, he stopped a trial. I think he called it a mistrial because the jury did not reflect the community. It was an African-American being tried. I think it might have been a higher court felony. But he got criticized for that. Is there other things that judges can do to make sure that Blacks, Black and Brown, see people that reflect them? Are there strikes that could be given to the prosecutor side, the state attorney side, to make sure that jury has someone of color there? And I get your part starting from the ground up, and that's going to take a while. It's going to take a while for that to build, that momentum to build. We're talking about a cultural change. But is there any power that the judge can say, you know what, we're not going to have this trial if this trial doesn't reflect this defendant who is from Pine Hills, 80,000 people in Pine Hills? Can we get a couple people from Pine Hills to at least to be part of this 12?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, there are things that can be done. One of the things that happens in jury trials, which is why I think it's important for our judiciary to have jury trial experience, is that when we do voir dire, which is a fancy Latin word for jury questioning, right?
Okay, right.
The way that we start that is a jury panel comes up from the jury room and they all enter the courtroom. They're assigned numbers. And normally what happens is that the judge addresses the jury panel first, long before the plaintiff and the defense starts talking to them and questioning them. And I think one of the things if you have a judge who has a lot of trial experience as a former trial lawyer, is that instead of just asking the basic questions that judges learn about in Judicial College as a trial, as when they're going to become, when they're going to be presiding over jury cases, is that a judge that really has a lot of trial experience can get in and really start asking jurors about some of their biases. And that's when you really start, when a judge could really have an impact on making sure that a jury, a potential juror, is able to really kind of expose some of their biases. Because what you find out is that sometimes jurors, potential jurors during that veneery is what we call them, they sometimes won't answer questions of attorneys. It depends on if you have a good trial lawyer or not, if you can get them talking, right? You got to kind of have the personality to get them talking, or else they like clam up like little clams and they don't really say anything. You got to kind of have a personality that gets them feeling comfortable. You're not going to be able to ask somebody, okay, so who here is a racist and a bigot? And they're just going to like put their hand up and be like, oh, that's me.
That's me, right?
You got me right here. Juror number 123, that's me, right? You have to know how to ask them things, you know, that maybe will get them talking. And then you get, sometimes you're lucky enough to get one that's like Motormouth Michael, and juror in seat number 7. Mm-hmm. And then you get other jurors to feel comfortable because Motormouth Michael has said something. But typically, jurors are much more open to answer a judge's questions right off the bat, because they feel like the judge is in the seat of authority, and they feel like, oh, I got to answer his or her questions, right? So I feel like if you have a judge that's got lots of trial experience and now all of a sudden they have the black robe on, as long as it's within the confines of what a judge is allowed to do, which is a lot of leeway, a judge can ask, especially when we're dealing right now in the court system and with what all we're dealing with, if it's pertinent to what's going on in his or her courtroom and they're savvy about it. I think a judge absolutely can ask about. So we've heard a lot, ladies and gentlemen, in our community about implicit bias. We've heard a lot about, you know, biases against police, biases against, you know, blacks, browns, whites, right now we're dealing with coronavirus. It comes back, right? And we start dealing with juries right off the bat. And so I think a judge could absolutely say, we've heard a lot about biases when it comes to Asian Americans. Is there anybody here that, you know, you got your jury summons, you knew you were going to be one of the first jury panels to come up right after coronavirus, and you thought to yourself, good God, I hope there is not an Asian American sitting next to me that recently traveled to somewhere in Asia that's going to cough on me and give me the coronavirus. Mm. Okay, well, so everybody kind of giggles, but at the same time, someone may give you the eyebrow lift, like, and if a judge is watching,
right,
and then all of a sudden watches that lift and says, juror in seat number 7, is that something you were concerned about? It's okay if you were. I mean, we're all concerned about, you know, things that may affect our health. Tell me about that face that you made. And then the judge looks like they're genuinely concerned about your health. And all of a sudden, juror in seat number 7 is like, well, judge, I have to be honest. I was downstairs in the jury room and there was somebody that looked like they were Asian next to me. And it made me worried that they may give me the bird flu and I may die now. Okay, well, now we've started a dialect and now everybody in the room knows that that juror probably is not going to be a great juror for this case if the defendant is Asian.
Right, right.
Wow. We haven't like embarrassed him, but now we know, right? And so I think that's a way that judges, if they're experienced trial lawyers, can start to make the courtroom more fair for everyone, whether they're black, brown, Asian, you know, depending on the set of circumstances.
Wow. We're live on 98.5 The Wire, live on Facebook, YouTube. Attorney Arnold is here with us today, running for judge here in Orange County. Definitely know that you have a diverse family. Your husband is black, and of course, your kids are black. Have you been involved in the black community? Do they know about Attorney Arnold?
Do my children know?
No, or no, no. Do you have you been involved?
Know about Attorney Arnold?
Yeah, they, I know they know about you. Well, their mom and daddies are attorneys. I'm sure they know about. But now, do the Black community know about Attorney Arnold? What has been your activities, engagement with the Black and Brown community in Orange County?
So the first 12 years of my practice was exclusively criminal defense on the state and federal level here in Orange and Osceola counties. I have defended cases anywhere from simple battery and driving on a suspended license all the way up to first degree murder cases. I have defended persons accused of drug trafficking and armed robbery and everything in between. To be quite honest with you, I have represented every intermediate and high level accused drug dealer off every numbered street from OBT and Gore all the way up Westmoreland, Jackson Street, and everywhere in between, around Pine Hills. When I first started my career, I used to travel up and down the numbered streets on Friday afternoon and meet my clients to pick up the payments that they owed to me. I was kind of a one-stop shop. I learned a lot about broadening my horizons from my clients. My clients taught me a lot about what slang meant there. Sometimes I would not know what things meant in police reports. And some of my clients became my really good friends who I trusted. And they would tell me, you know, what things meant and meant in police reports and educate.
Street code. Get you the street code.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I learned a lot about, you know, I once had a client tell me I was gated in the streets. At first I thought I needed to punch him in the mouth. But later found out that was a good thing. You know, I have done a lot for the community that gave me the career that I have had and that I've been very blessed to have. A lot of that has been silently in the background because that just has never been me. I've never been one to want to be in the limelight. I've never wanted to be something that I wasn't or tried to fit in where I didn't belong. But I've always been welcomed in the community with my clients. They've welcomed me with open arms. My husband and I have contributed to food drives in the community for years. We have been a little more forefront during this campaign because it was needed. I was told I needed to be out in the front and have my face be seen. People needed to see me. But just because my community service has not always been out in the front doesn't mean that it wasn't happening. But I would venture to say, to be real honest with you, my face has been Gator. I see it. I've been called a pit bull in a skirt my entire career. It's something I'm very proud of. I don't hide from it. Just because I don't pose for pictures while I'm completing community service or while I've been in the community isn't because the community isn't important to me. It's quite the opposite. It's because the community was important to me to be making it better. It wasn't important for me to be seen in it. And that's just truly how I feel about it. I feel as though most of your listeners would type up who are listening that aren't busy at work right now and would tell you, yes, that quite honestly, they all are familiar with me. Maybe not all of them have always been happy, unfortunately, based upon the sheer number of clients that I've represented in the community. Some of them have gone to jail. I can't get everyone off all the time, but at the end of the day, I would tell you that most people in the community would tell you that I've worked my ass off for them and their family members. That's just who I am and who I've always been.
Right. Got a question for you. Just coming from Jay with Pine Hills Partnership. What has it been like campaigning for this position? Is boosting voter awareness a challenge?
Campaigning for the position has actually been really great. It's like I said, it's been a little bit of a change in dynamic. So instead of sort of being in the background, I've needed to be a little bit more in the forefront, which has been just kind of a change in my mindset, I think, more than anything. As far as boosting voter awareness, it has been a bit of a challenge only because judicial races are very unique from other political positions, in the fact that we have what are on top of all of the other political rules that we have to follow. We also, at the moment we become a judicial candidate and declare for office, we are bound by a set of rules called the judicial canons, and they're the same set of rules that judges are bound by. And so we, for instance, we can't go to any events that are partisan based. So if if someone in political office, so like let's say Senator Bracey threw an event that was political in nature and political based, I could not attend it. Now Senator Bracey threw a voter registration event 2 weekends ago that right. was nonpartisan in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and I was able to attend that because it wasn't partisan in nature. But it's unique in the fact that, like, when people ask me certain things, one of the things that voters love to ask me all over Facebook and my Facebook page is whether or not I'm a Republican or a Democrat. I can't answer that. I'm nonpartisan. I am nonpartisan. My race is nonpartisan. Everything about me right now has to be nonpartisan. So for the last 22 months that I've been campaigning, I basically can talk about what is my favorite color, what do I like to eat. I can talk about my kids, but I can't talk about issues that could come before me. So I can't talk about like what my position is on the death penalty or medical marijuana or the legalization of marijuana, all the things that you hear state attorney candidates talking about. I can't talk about any of those things.
So if we go back and look at these tapes, we're not going to find you at the Trump and Pence rallies.
You are not going to see me at any of those rallies.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's concerning. So speaking of death penalty, you're running for circuit court judge.
Yes, sir.
Do you have a problem sentencing someone to death?
I will not have a problem sentencing someone to death if the jury follows the law and it is proven to the jury and that's the recommendation that they make, and if our law is still standing that it needs to be unanimous. Right now the death penalty position is kind of up in the air still, as you may know. Prior to about a year and a half ago, the jury did not have to unanimously, meaning all of them, all 12 of them agree to the death penalty. It could be a split decision. Then a little over a year and a half ago, the Supreme Court ruled that it did have to be a unanimous decision, which is why so many death penalty cases came back on right. review for resentencing. And just recently, prior to COVID, there was another Supreme Court ruling in Florida that kind of got us all up in arms again and put us in this limbo position that now it does not have to be unanimous. And so we're in a catch-22 again. And so I think until that gets sorted out, death penalty cases are sort of in limbo all over again. But once the law is decided, it is what I would like, what we like to, as attorneys, say, well settled. I don't have any problem following the law. I'm a law follower. I'm a rule follower. I like to follow the rules. I'm pretty adamant about that. At the end of the day, you know, the jury makes a recommendation and it's their determination to do that. My job as a judge in jury cases is to follow the law. And that's what I would do.
All right, Attorney Arnold, help me out on your first name. I don't know if it's Rihanna, Rihanna,
Rhiannon.
So Rhiannon.
It's like Shannon, but Rhiannon.
And it's original. You didn't change your name.
I did not change my name. Do you want to talk about that? Let's talk about it. Let's just get it out.
What's happening up there in Pensacola?
Let's just get it out because I like it.
Right.
This rumor is like the best rumor mill rumor ever. So let's let your voters be the first one to hear it from the horse's mouth.
What happened? How did you get your name?
So I was born. My mom and dad love Fleetwood Mac.
Okay,
the band Fleetwood Mac, the hippie band Fleetwood Mac. The song number one on their greatest hits album is Rhiannon. I was born Jennifer Rhiannon Arnold. That's the name on my birth certificate. That is my government name. Okay. Right. From the day I was born, they have always called me Rhiannon. Everybody. Okay. In school, when they registered me in school, like all parents just had to do for their new babies that were going to kindergarten,
right,
they registered me as Jennifer Rhiannon Arnold because that's my government name. But then what does your child like to be called? Rhiannon. Everybody has always called me Rhiannon. If somebody calls me Jennifer to this day, I don't answer because I don't register that as being my name. Okay. When I was arrested in 2009, the police did not ask me how I would like to be booked. They arrested me under my government name, Jennifer Rhiannon Arnold. So when it was determined that they had illegally arrested me and there was no probable cause for my arrest, and I made the decision that I was going to sue them for that, sue the city for their policies of entering my home without a warrant to arrest me under no probable cause, I had to sue them under my government name.
Okay.
When I got ready to sue them, I had gotten married. I got arrested 31 days before I got married. So I sued them under my now government name, Jennifer Rhiannon Arnold Rogers. I have never practiced under the name Jennifer ever with the Florida Bar. I've never been registered as Jennifer with the Florida Bar. At best, at one point in time, I had the letter J with the Florida Bar just because it was my part of my government name, but no one in Orlando has ever called me Jennifer. I've never been registered as Jennifer. I did not drop Jennifer to hide my arrest. I had never sealed or expunged my arrest because I didn't do anything wrong and I don't have any reason to hide it. There's no issues with my arrest. So I don't have a name change. I never legally changed my name. My parents just wanted to make things difficult for me and give me a first name that they never intended to call me. Mm. They just tried to make it fun. I've always been Rhiannon.
You know, we didn't expect you to talk about this. This already been discussed, but we appreciate your transparency.
You're welcome.
For listeners out there, being real, people want somebody who's real and transparent. You didn't have to bring that up because nothing happened. But it's not there. Anything else you want to share with Orlando?
You know, that's really the truth. I mean, what you just said is really kind of who I am. I mean, I'm just transparent. I mean, the arrest happened. It made me, I wish it had never happened. I mean, true enough. Everybody wishes that, you know, they never had been arrested, right? They'd never had a run-in with law enforcement. Right. But at the end of the day, it made me a better lawyer. It made me better at my career long-term. Now looking back at it, you know, 11 years later, it made me a much better lawyer. It made me much more relatable when it comes to my clients. I can have I can literally have a much more realistic conversation with my clients, not just my criminal clients. And when I say that, I mean my clients that are charged with criminal acts, mm-hmm. not that they are criminals, but also even my personal injury clients. I understand the burden of proof much better. I understand when clients tell me I was fearful just because he had a badge and a gun. I get it. I get it when clients tell me, Miss Arnold, I knew that I hadn't done anything wrong, but I had a hard time just explaining, even giving my name to the police because I was so fearful. Like just being in the situation made me fearful. I get it now. Right. And I think before, because I had never had any exposure like that, I wasn't able to understand that. It's hard to understand a situation like that if you've never been through it. I've been through it, and so I understand what people who talk to me about those situations have been through, because I've been through it myself. I think that's one of the things that will make me a good judge, is because I think when people come before me and they are talking to me about a situation, especially on the criminal bench, I think that I'm going to have a good bullshit meter. I think I'm going to be able to tell who's telling me the truth and who's not, you know, who's putting on and who's not. And I think that I'm not going to say that, you know, I'm a mom now, and I think that's changed some things in me. I think anybody who's become a parent can understand that when you have kids of your own, it changes your psyche. It changes the way you look at the world. But I'm not going to say that I'm sympathetic to everything, because I'm not, but I think that I'm very empathetic. I think that I have a unique ability inside myself that a lot of people do not have, to be very empathetic. I think that I have the ability to put myself in other people's shoes, mm-hmm. and see things from other people's viewpoint that a lot of people don't have. I also think that in a world where everybody right now wants to make things black versus white, I think that I have a really unique perspective. I will never know what it's like to be black or brown, ever. And I'm not trying to act like I do. But I do think that I have a unique perspective and a unique set of lenses, living with a black husband every day and raising black children, that I'm not blind to the fact that I and people who look like me, we have a different viewpoint, and we have an automatic different card than people who are black or brown.
Do you worry about your husband getting killed by the police or the street?
Yeah, sure. For instance, I don't like him to drive my vehicle, because my vehicle is registered to me. His vehicle is registered to him. I have a legal window tint on my vehicle that my doctor has given me permission to have. And it freaks me out when he drives my vehicle, because his name's not on the registration. And I worry if he, you know, if they pull him over and he rolls down the window and they can't see in the vehicle when they're approaching it, and he rolls down the window, you know, is that a concern that he could spook somebody and be treated in a different manner? Right. Yes.
Right.
I mean, we live in Bowie. I worry, you know, if he goes and rides his bike down the trail, is he going to come home?
There you go. Okay. We got to go. Thank you so much for your time. That's 33 minutes straight talk with attorney Rhiannon Arnold. Look her up. What's the website?
It's Arnold, the number 4 judge. That's on all my social media handles. So that's on the website, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
All righty. Good luck. And where are you going to be at Tuesday night? Where are you hanging out at? Where's the party at?
We're going to be at our office doing a watch party.
All righty. Well, thank you once again for joining the conversation on 98.5 The Wire. And we'll be in contact with you, okay?
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Back to more music. Stay after the jams, 98.5.